here, on the grass beside the lake, build a house. It doesn't need to be large, but it should be fully equipped for modern living. The style can be either classical or modern, but it should complement its natural surroundings. And the necessary facilities, fountains, a swimming pool, should be provided so that its master can live the comfortable life of the aristocracy.
And who will its master be?
Myself.
What are you going to do there?
Live out my days in peace. Luoji waited for Garanine to say something rude, but the chair simply nodded gravely and said,
After an audit by the commission, we will carry this out at once.
You and your commission won't raise any questions about my motivation? Garanine shrugged.
The commission can question the wall faces in two areas. Use of resources exceeding the set scope and harm caused to human lives. Apart from these, all questions are in violation of the spirit of the Wallfacer project. And truth be told, Tyler, Ray Diaz, and Hines have left me disappointed. Looking at their strategizing over the past 2 days, you can tell immediately what they are up to with their grand strategic plans. You're different from them. Your behavior is baffling. That's what a Wallfacer should be like.
Do you really believe the place I describe exists? Garanine smiled, winked, and made an okay sign.
The world is big enough to have a place like that. Besides, to tell you the truth, I've seen it before.
Well, that's wonderful, truly. And make sure that I can live a comfortable aristocrat's life. This is part of the Wallfacer project. Garanine nodded gravely. Oh, and one other thing. When you find a suitable place, never tell me where it is.
No, can't say where it is. Once I know where I am, then the world becomes as narrow as a map. When I don't know, the world feels unlimited.
Garanine nodded again, seemingly pleased this time.
Dr. Luo, you've got another trait that satisfies my notion of being a Wallfacer. Your project requires the smallest investment of the four, at least for the time being. If that's the case, then mine will never have the largest investment. Then you'll be a blessing to all my successors. Money is a real headache. The specific departments in charge of executing this may consult with you on some details, the house in particular, I think.
Oh, the house, Luoji said. I forgot one very important detail.
Go on.
Luoji imitated Garanine's wink and smile. It needs a fireplace. After his father's funeral, Zheng Beihai went with Wu Yue one more time to the carrier dry dock, where construction on Tang had been suspended entirely. The welding sparks had vanished from the hull, and there were no signs of life anywhere on the giant ship lying in the noonday sun. The overarching impression it gave was one of the passage of time.
It's dead, Zheng Beihai said. Your father was one of the wisest generals among the Navy's top brass. If he were still with us, I might not have gotten so thoroughly stuck, Wu Yue said.
Zheng Beihai said,
Your defeatism is built on a rational basis, or at least it's your own reasoning, so I don't believe there's anyone who can truly cheer you up. I'm not here to apologize, Wu Yue. I know you don't hate me over this.
I'd like to thank you, Beihai. You got me out.
You can return to the Navy. Working there should suit you quite well. Wu Yue shook his head slowly.
I've submitted my discharge application. What would I do if I went back? Construction on the new destroyers and frigates has stopped, and I no longer have any place in the fleet. Sit in an office in fleet command? Forget it. Besides, I'm not a good soldier at all. A soldier who's only willing to engage in a winnable war is unqualified to be one.
Victory or defeat
is not for us to see. But you have faith in victory, Beihai. I envy you, really, to the point of jealousy. Faith like yours is the height of happiness for a military man these days. You truly are your father's son. So, do you have any plans?
No. I feel like my life is over. Wu Yue pointed at Tang in the distance. Just like that. Over before it even launched.
A low rumble came from the direction of the shipyard, and Tang slowly started to move. To vacate the dock, it had to take to the water ahead of schedule and be towed to another dock for demolition. When Tang's sharp prow split the seawater, Zheng Beihai and Wu Yue sensed a trace of anger in the massive hull. Quickly, it entered the sea, tossing up huge waves that caused the other boats in the port to rock as if paying tribute. Tang crept slowly forward in the water, quietly enjoying the sea's embrace. In its brief and aborted career, this giant ship had at least met the ocean once. In the virtual three-body world, it was the dead of night. Apart from scraps of starlight, all was immersed in an inky blackness, so that even the horizon was invisible, and the empty land and sky blended together in the dark.
Administrator, start up a stable era. Can't you see we're holding a meeting?
Shouted a voice. The administrator's voice seemed to come from the sky itself.
I can't do that. The era is run randomly along the core model and can't be set externally.
Another voice in the darkness said,
Then increase the speed and find some stable daylight. It won't take too long.
The world flashed. Suns flew across the sky, and soon time returned to normal. One stable sun illuminated the world.
Okay, I don't know how long this will last, the administrator said.
The sun shone in the wilderness on a group of people. Some familiar faces among them, King Wen of Zhou, Newton, von Neumann, Aristotle, Mozi, Confucius and Einstein. Sparsely distributed, they faced Qin Shi Huang, who stood on a rock with a sword across his shoulders.
I'm not alone, he said. This is the core leadership of Seven speaking.
You shouldn't be talking about a new leadership before it's been finalized, someone said, and a clamour rose among the rest.
Enough,
Qin Shi Huang said, struggling to raise the sword.
Setting aside the leadership controversy for the moment, we shall turn to more pressing matters. We all know of the launch of the Wallfacer project, humanity's attempt to use closed-off private strategic thinking to resist Sophon's surveillance. Since the Lord's transparent mind cannot possibly thread that labyrinth, humanity has regained its edge through this plan, and the four Wallfacers pose a threat to the Lord. In accordance with the resolution of the previous offline meeting, we must launch the Wall Breaker Project immediately.
At those last words, silence reigned, and no one voiced any objections. Then Qin Shi Huang said,
We will appoint a Wall Breaker for each Wall Facer. Like the Wall Facers, the Wall Breakers will be authorized to tap all of the organization's resources, but their greatest resource will be the Sophons, which will render the Wall Facers' every action utterly exposed. The only secret will be their thoughts. The Wall Breakers' mission, then, is to analyze the Wall Facers' open and clandestine actions. With the help of the Sophons, and decipher the true nature of their strategic aims as early as possible. The leadership will now appoint the Wall Breakers.
Qin Shi Huang extended the sword and, as if conferring knighthood, touched it to von Neumann's shoulder.
"You are the first wall-breaker," he said. "You are Frederick Tyler's wall-breaker."
Von Neumann knelt down and placed his left hand to his right shoulder in a salute.
"I accept the mission."
Qin Shi Huang touched the sword to Mo Zi's shoulder.
"You are the second wall-breaker. You are Manuel Ray Diaz's wall-breaker."
Mo Zi did not kneel, but stood straight and nodded haughtily.
"I will be the first to break a wall."
The sword touched Aristotle's shoulder.
"You are the third wall-breaker. You are Bill Hines's wall-breaker."
Aristotle did not kneel either, but shook his robe and said thoughtfully,
"Yes, I'm the only one who can break his wall."
Qin Shi Huang returned the sword to his own shoulder and swept his gaze across the crowd.
"Good. We now have wall breakers. You, like the wall facers, are the elite of the elite. The Lord be with you. Assisted by hibernation, you will start the long journey to the end of days together with the wall facers."
"I don't think hibernation is necessary," Aristotle said. "I can complete the wall-breaker mission before we finish our normal lifespan."
Mo Zi nodded in agreement.
"When I break the wall, I will face my wall-facer in person, and I will savour how his spirit collapses in anguish and despair. Devoting the rest of my life to this is well worth it."
The final wall-breaker likewise stated his intent to break their wall-facers in person. Von Neumann said,
"We will unmask the last traces of every secret that humanity harbours from the Sophons. This is the final thing we can do for the Lord, for afterwards there will be no reason for us to exist."
"What about Luo Ji's wall-breaker?" someone asked. The question seemed to touch something in Qin Shi Huang's mind. He planted the sword into the ground and fell deep in thought. The sun suddenly sped up its descent to the earth, lengthening the shadows until they extended to the horizon. When it had set halfway, it abruptly changed direction and rose and fell a few times along the horizon like the gleaming back of a whale cresting out of the black ocean, pulling the vast wilderness and the small group of people that made up this stark world back and forth between light and darkness.
"Luo Ji is his own wall-breaker. He needs to find out what threat he poses to the Lord," Qin Shi Huang said.
"Do we know whether or not he is a threat?" someone asked.
"I don't know, but the Lord knows. And Evans knew. Evans taught the Lord how to keep this secret, and he's dead. We can't know."
"So of all the wall facers, is Luo Ji the greatest threat?"
someone hesitantly asked.
"We don't know that either. Only one thing is clear,"
Qin Shi Huang said, looking up at the canopy of the sky as it changed from blue to black.
"Out of the four wall faces, he is the only one in direct contest with the Lord."
Work meeting, Space Force Political Department. Cheng Wei Sir stayed silent for a long while after opening the meeting, something he had never done before. He swept his eyes across the two rows of political officers at the conference table, then looked into the infinite distance while gently tapping his pencil on the tabletop, a light tapping that seemed to mark time for his thoughts. At last, he pulled himself out of his reverie.
"Comrades, by an order announced yesterday by the Central Military Commission, I am now serving as commander of the Political Department of the Armed Forces. I accepted the appointment 1 week ago, but only now that we are seated together do I feel conflicted."
I have suddenly realized that in front of me is the most beleaguered group of people in the Space Force, and now I am one of your number. I didn't realize this before, and for this I apologize to you." He opened the document in front of him. "This portion of the meeting will be off the record. Comrades, let us have a candid exchange of views. Let us be Trisolarans for once and open our thoughts to each other. This is crucial for our future work."
Cheng Wei Sir's gaze lingered on the face of each officer for a second or two, but they remained silent. And then he stood up and paced along the table behind the row of seated officers.
"Our duty is to build in our forces the faith that we will be victorious in the future war. So, do we have that faith in ourselves? Please, raise your hands if you do. Remember, we are speaking our minds."
No one raised a hand. Nearly everyone was staring at the table. But Cheng Wei Sir noticed one man's gaze was fixed straight ahead. Zheng Beihai. He went on.
"Do you believe that victory is possible? By possible, I mean not an accidental few tenths of a percent, but an actual meaningful possibility."
Zheng Beihai raised a hand. His was the only hand raised.
"First, let me thank all of you for your honesty," Cheng Wei Sir said, and then turned to Zheng Beihai. "Excellent, Comrade Zheng. Tell us, on what do you base your confidence?"
Zheng Beihai stood up, but Cheng Wei Sir motioned for him to sit down again.
"This is not a formal meeting," he said. "It's just a heart-to-heart chat."
Still standing at attention, Zheng Beihai said, "Commander, I can't answer your question sufficiently in just a few words because building faith is a long and complicated process. First of all, I'd like to make note of the mistaken thinking among the troops at the present time. We all know that prior to the Trisolar crisis, we had been advocating for the examination of the future of war from scientific and rational perspectives, and a powerful inertia has sustained this mentality to the present day. This is particularly the case in the present Space Force, where it has been exacerbated by the influx of a large number of academics and scientists. If we use this mentality to contemplate an interstellar war 4 centuries in the future, we'll never be able to establish faith in a victory."
"What Comrade Zheng Beihai says is peculiar," a colonel said. "Is steadfast faith not built upon science and reason? No faith is solid that is not founded on objective fact."
"Then let's take another look at science and reason. Our own science and reason, remember?"
"The Trisolarans' advanced development tells us that our science is no more than a child collecting shells on the beach who hasn't even seen the ocean of truth. The facts we see under the guidance of our science and reason may not be the true objective facts. And since that's the case, we need to learn how to selectively ignore them. We should see how things change as they develop, and we shouldn't write off the future through technological determinism and mechanical materialism."
"Excellent," Cheng Wei Sir said, and nodded at him to continue.
"We must establish faith in victory, a faith that is the foundation of military duty and dignity. When the Chinese military once faced a powerful enemy under extremely poor conditions, it established a firm faith in victory through a sense of responsibility to the people and the motherland. I believe that today, a sense of responsibility to the human race and to Earth civilization can encourage the same faith."
"But how are we supposed to go about specific ideological work?" asked an officer.
"The Space Force is made up of complicated parts, which means that its ideology is complex. We've got our work cut out for us."
"I think that for the time being, at least, we should start with the mental condition of the troops," Zheng Beihai said. "Big picture.
Last week I visited troops from the Air Force and Naval Air Force that have just been brought under our branch, and I discovered that day-to-day training for these forces is incredibly slack. Small picture. Problems with military discipline are cropping up with increasing frequency. There was supposed to be a total switch to summer uniforms, but lots of people in headquarters are still wearing their winter uniforms. This state of mind must be changed as quickly as possible. Look, the Space Force is turning into an academy of sciences. Of course, we can't deny that its present mission is that of an academy of military sciences, but we ought to be conscious that we are an army, and we're an army in a state of war. The conversation went on for a while longer, and then Chung Wei Sir returned to his seat.
Thank you. I hope that we will be able to continue having frank conversations. Now, let's move on to the contents of the formal meeting.
As he spoke, he looked up and once again saw Zhang Beihai's steady gaze, which revealed a determination that warmed his heart a little. Zhang Beihai, I know you have faith. With a father like that, it would be impossible for you not to. But things are definitely not as simple as you say. I don't know what you base your faith on, and I don't even know what else your faith encompasses. But just like your father. I admired him, but I have to admit that in the end, I couldn't figure him out.
Chung Wei Sir flipped open the document in front of him. Research on space warfare theory is in full swing at present, but one problem has already cropped up. The study of interplanetary warfare needs to be founded on a certain level of technological development, no doubt about it. But right now, basic research has only just begun, and technological breakthroughs will occur far in the future. This means our research has no support. Headquarters have revised the research plan in light of the circumstances and has divided unified research on the theory of space warfare into three parts to cater to the possible technological levels that the human world may reach in the future. Namely, a low-tech strategy, a mid-tech strategy, and a high-tech strategy. Work is currently in progress to define these three levels of technology, as well as to define a large number of index parameters in every major scientific discipline. But the core parameter will be the speed and range of a 10-kiloton class spaceship. The low-tech level. Spacecraft speed achieves 50 times the third cosmic velocity, or roughly 800 kilometers per second. Spacecraft are not equipped with life support. Under these conditions, the craft has a combat radius limited to the inner solar system, that is, within Neptune's orbit, or 30 AU from the Sun. The mid-tech level. Spacecraft speed achieves 300 times the third cosmic velocity, or 4,800 kilometers per second. Spacecraft are equipped with partial life support. Under these conditions, the combat radius of the craft extends beyond the Kuiper Belt and includes all space within 1,000 AU of the Sun. The high-tech level. Spacecraft speed achieves 1,000 times the third cosmic velocity, or 16,000 kilometers per second, which is 5% of the speed of light. Spacecraft are fully equipped with life support. Under these conditions, the combat radius extends to the Oort cloud, with preliminary interstellar navigation capabilities. Defeatism is the greatest threat to the armed forces in space. So political and ideological workers will shoulder an extremely important responsibility in the Space Force. Political departments in the military will participate fully in the study of space warfare theory to eradicate the stain of defeatism and guarantee the correct direction of research. Those of you present today will become members of a space warfare theory task force.
although there will be some overlap among members of the three branches, the research institutions are independent and will tentatively be known as the Institute for Low-Tech Strategy, the Institute for Mid-Tech Strategy, and the Institute for High-Tech Strategy. At today's meeting, I'd like to hear from each of you which one you would choose. As a reference for the political department's next round of work appointments, let's share our selections. Of the 32 political officers at the meeting, 24 selected low-tech and 7 selected mid-tech. Just one officer chose high-tech, Zheng Beihai.
"Looks like Comrade Beihai wants to get into science fiction," someone said to scattered laughter.
"My choice is the only hope for victory. That's the only level of technology that gives humanity any chance of building an effective defence system for the Earth and solar system," Zheng Beihai said.
"We haven't even mastered controlled nuclear fusion, sending a 10,000-ton warship to 5% of the speed of light. 10,000 times faster than the truck-sized spacecraft humanity has today. It's not even science fiction, it's fantasy."
"But don't we have 4 more centuries? We've got to keep potential progress in mind."
"But progress in fundamental physics is impossible."
"We haven't even tapped 1% of the potential applications of existing theories," Zheng Beihai said. "My feeling is that the biggest problem right now is the technology sector's approach to research. They're wasting too much time and money on low-end technology. In propulsion, for example, there's no reason at all to work on the fission drive. But right now, they're not only throwing huge amounts of R&D at it, they're even putting the same amount of effort into studying next-gen chemical propulsion. We should focus our resources on studying fusion engines and move directly to the development of media-free fusion engines, leapfrogging media-based fusion. The same problem exists in other areas of research. Sealed ecosystems, for instance, are a necessary technology for interstellar spacecraft, one that is not particularly dependent on fundamental theory, but research in this area is very limited."
Cheng Wei Sir said,
"Comrade Zheng Beihai has posed at least one question worthy of attention. The military and scientific communities are all busy starting their own work, but there is insufficient communication among them. Fortunately, both sides are aware of the situation and are organizing a joint conference, and the military and the scientific communities have each established special agencies to strengthen communication between the two sides and establish a fully interactive relationship between space strategy and scientific research. The next step is to dispatch military representatives to the various research areas and to involve a large group of scientists in studying the theory of space warfare. Again, we can't sit and wait for technological breakthroughs. We ought to form our own ideological strategy as soon as possible and then promote it in every field. Next, I'd like to talk about another layer of relationships, that between the Space Force and the Wall Facers."
"The Wall Facers?" someone asked in wonder. "Are they going to interfere in Space Force work?"
"There's no sign of that at the moment, although Tyler has proposed paying an inspection visit to the military. But we ought to realise that they do have that power, and any interference that does take place may have unanticipated effects. We need to be mentally prepared for it. When such a situation does occur, we should maintain a balance between the Wallfacer project and mainstream defence."
After the meeting, Cheng Wei Sir sat alone in the empty conference room smoking a cigarette. The smoke wafted into a beam of sunlight shining through the window and seemed to catch fire. "Whatever happens, at least it's begun," he thought to himself.
For the first time, Luo Ji felt that a dream had come true. He had imagined that Garanin was only boasting. Of course he could find a stunning, untouched place, but it was certain to be quite different from the place in his imagination. But when he got off the helicopter, it was like he had stepped into a dream world. The distant snow peaks, the lake in front of him, the grassy plain and forest beside the lake, all of it laid out exactly as he had sketched it for Garanin. And he hadn't dared permit himself to imagine such an immaculate environment. Everything seemed to have sprung out of a fairy tale. There was a slight sweetness to the fresh air, and even the sun seemed to be cautious, sending the softest and most exquisite part of its glow into this place. The most incredible thing was the small estate beside the lake and the villa at its heart. Kent, who was travelling with him, said the house was built in the mid-19th century, but it looked older, and the passage of time had made it blend with its environment.
"Don't be surprised. Sometimes people dream of places that really exist," Kent said.
"Does anyone live here?" Luo Ji asked.
"No one in a 5-kilometer radius. Beyond that, there are a few small villages."
Luo Ji guessed that the place might be in northern Europe, but he didn't ask. Kent led him into the house. With his first glance at the spacious European-style living room, Luo Ji saw a fireplace with fruit wood stacked neatly next to it that gave off a fresh fragrance.
"The former master of the house bids you welcome. He is proud to have a wallfacer living here."
Kent went on to tell him that the estate contained more than just the facilities he had requested. Stables with 10 horses, because the best way to get to the mountains was by walking and riding. A tennis court and a golf course. A wine cellar and, on the lake, a motorboat and a few sailboats. Beneath its old exterior, the house had been fully modernized. Every room was equipped with a computer, broadband, and satellite television, and there was a digital projection room as well. In addition to all of this, Luo Ji had noticed a helipad when he arrived. It was clearly not built at the last minute.
"The man's got money." "Not just money. He doesn't want to disclose his identity, but you would probably recognize his name if I told you. He donated the land to the UN, a far larger gift than Rockefeller's. Just so you're clear, the land and all of the real estate on it belong to the UN. You only have right of residence, but you're not getting nothing. When the owner left, he said that he had taken away all of his personal belongings and that whatever is left is yours. These paintings alone must be worth quite a bit."
Kent took Luo Ji on a tour of every room in the house. He noticed that the original owner had good taste and had furnished every room with a sense of elegant tranquility. A considerable portion of the books in the library were old Latin editions. The paintings were mostly in the modernist style, but they did not seem out of place in rooms with such a rich classical atmosphere. One thing in particular that struck him was the total absence of landscapes. The mark of a mature aesthetic sensibility, hanging landscape paintings in a house situated in the Garden of Eden, would be as pointless as pouring a bucket of water into the ocean. Returning to the living room, Luo Ji sat down on the deliciously comfortable chair in front of the fireplace. He stretched out his hand and brushed against an object, which he then picked up and inspected. A church warden pipe, kind with a long, thin stem, used indoors by the leisure class. He looked toward the wall and its empty shelves and imagined what had been taken down. Then Kent came in and introduced a few people, the housekeeper, cook, driver, groom, and boatmaster, all of whom had been in the previous owner's service. When they had gone,
Kent introduced him to a lieutenant colonel in civvies, who was responsible for security. After he left, Luo Ji asked Kent where Shi Qiang was.
"He's handed over your security detail and has probably returned home."
"Let him take the place of that guy just now. I think he'll do a better job."
"I feel the same way, but he doesn't speak English. It will be hard for him to do his job."
"Then bring in Chinese guards to replace the ones here." Kent agreed and left to make the call. Luo Ji also left the room and walked across the manicured lawn onto a pier leading out into the middle of the lake. He held the railings at the end and gazed at the reflection of the snow caps in the lake's mirror surface. Surrounded by sweet air and sunshine, he said to himself, "Compared to life today, what does the world 4 centuries from now matter?" Screw the Wallfacer project.